mostly a knotted and tangled mass these days, and he roamed about the chateau in a long, ornamented gown called a kurta, with silken pajamas under it, his feet bare. In Fontaine's story, Arjun was splendidly dressed as an 18th-century gentleman in shimmering gold brocade and lace with breeches and white stockings and shoes with bejeweled buckles, his hair hidden by a crimson turban. His face was hideous, deformed by rage and hatred. "I will let you live," Arjun said, "for one good reason, that she will make my existence hell if I do to you what I want. But if I ever lay eyes on you again, Mitka, I will burn you alive." And, having said this in his soft, dark voice, he turned this power of his, this evil power, to immolate living creatures with his mind. He turned this power on a great painting on the wall, and I saw it turn black and wither and then burst into tiny flames as it fell in smoking fragments to the floor. "You will die like that," he said to me, "and slowly, and you will be crying for me to end it before I do. Now go, get out of here." The Countess nodded to me and told me firmly not even to look at her, but to do what Arjun told me. "And this is why I cannot come to court, Lestat, because if he is there, he will do what he promised to do on that night." I reflected on this for a long moment. I was about to respond when he spoke again. "I swear to you," he said, "I have never done anything to offend him. Yes, I did love her, and I did covet her, but I swear to you that I did nothing to invite his enmity. He was offended at my very existence, and simply maddened to learn that she had given me the blood." "I understand," I said. Again I reflected, and then, after a long time, I said this. "He is at court, and he is difficult and cantankerous. He's a thorn in the side of Marius. I will go to the council and tell them this story, and then I will ask for him to come in and tell us if he has any objections to your coming to court. I will let him make the choice, either to accept your coming or to insist that you don't. And if he does insist that you cannot come, that he will destroy you if he sees you, well, I will demand to know why. If you've told me the truth, he will have no good reason. And it was for disputes like this that my authority, whatever its source, was made. I'll do my best for you. I will insist that he agree to forgive whatever injured him in the past." I could see that he was anxious and filled with misgiving. In a low voice, he began to say that perhaps this was too much to ask of me. "No," I said, "this is why I am the prince, so that all disputes of this kind can be settled, and so that all can come to court and in peace. You let me do what I must do, and I'm confident that I'll be sending for you very soon." He shuddered all over, as if he were about to cry, and then he rose to his feet, came toward me, and lifted my right hand, and kissed it. I stood, and we walked out of the parlor together. I suppose I had some vague idea of going back to New Orleans now, but really, I didn't want to leave Fontaine. It was far too late, of course, to return tonight to France. "But you trust in me," I told him. "There is one thing more," he said in a whisper.
"What is it?"
I cannot make the crossing of the sea as you do."
"Oh, yes, you can," I said. "Don't worry about this. I'll come back for you, and I'll show you how to do it. You're older than I am. You'll learn quite fast."
I did not want to go. He sensed it. An absurd thought came to me, that being here with him, being in this house, simply sitting at a table in his parlor and talking to him, it had all felt natural and good, as if, in spite of the topic of our conversation, we were simply human beings, and all the dark world didn't exist. I was ashamed of this. Why did we have to be like human beings, I demanded of myself? Why could we not simply be blood drinkers together? And there came over me again the realization of how new it was to me to love others of the tribe and accept them as beings that had a right to be alive as I was alive. I looked at him, at his shining eyes, his congenial smile, and he took my hand and said he wanted to show the house to me. We remained together for several hours after that, during which we walked through many rooms, and I admired not only the endless book collection that flowed from room to room, but many of his paintings, including a few Russian painters of the 19th century I'd never heard of before. Fontaine told me that his most valuable paintings were not here in this house, that after the attack of the Mavericks, he'd put them in a vault in a New Orleans bank, but that he might bring them to court if I would accept them. I was delighted. For me, this was a lovely time. I was overflowing with affection for him, called him Mitka easily, and finally did ask the inevitable simpleton questions. Did you really know Catherine the Great herself? And did you, in fact, speak to her? Yes, was the answer to both, and the question sparked a long reverie about what it had been like in St. Petersburg in those times, and how much he'd enjoyed the balls at court, and the passion of the Russians for all things French. Of course, the revolution in France had had a mighty impact, yet life in Russia had remained stable, and it had been unthinkable that revolution would occur there. We might have continued that conversation for a year. We walked about outside the house, through the gardens which were crowded with flowers and vines that blossom at night, and I saw Fontaine's stables, including the wreckage of the one which had been burned. And only towards the end of the night did he confide to me that the Mavericks had destroyed a young woman whom he'd wanted to bring into the blood. I felt this like a sword to my heart. I was furious. "And why they did this, I have no idea," he said. "Why come after me? Why trouble me? I never hunt in New Orleans. Why destroy those mortals who are attached to my house?" I wished the little beasts could have been brought back to life so that I might kill them all over again. I told him so. "And I was only waiting for your approval to bring her into the blood," he added. "You know, I wanted to meet you, to get your permission." This silenced me. But it was not the first time a blood drinker had volunteered this complete acceptance of the court and my position as the sovereign. "Surely you will be making rules as to who might be brought into the blood," he said as we kept walking. "Surely you will set some standards." I didn't answer. I knew that the council was considering this very thing. Yet all of us agreed that the right to make another blood drinker, to transform another human with our own blood, was such an intensely personal and intimate and emotional act that we did not know how to go about imposing a law on it. I tried to say something to that effect. "It's rather like telling humans that they cannot have children." I could see that he was now in such deep pain he couldn't talk. We continued down a long garden path and made a round of a large pond filled with monstrous goldfish flashing under the light of many Japanese lanterns along the shore. Finally, he said, "Well, what's the use of speaking of it now? They destroyed her. There was nothing left of her when they had done their work. I cannot, I will not dwell on it, wondering what were her last moments." I wanted to ask if the girl had known what he had planned, but why cause him more misery? I thought of my own architect, back in the village, on the mountain below the chateau, and my own plan to bring him over, and I thought I should act on that immediately. Since time immemorial, immortals had tormented other immortals by destroying human beings under their protection. Finally, I asked him about this Baudouin, whom he'd characterized as my enemy. I asked if Baudouin had any connection to the Mavericks, whom I'd just wiped out. "No," he said. "Baudouin is ancient, and I don't know him. He came to me with one purpose. He had heard about the books you've written and the court, and wanted to know what I thought of all this. When I didn't respond to his outrage at the idea of a monarchy or a court, he appeared to lose interest in me. I didn't have an easy moment in his presence. He was too old, too powerful." He paused looking at me, and then he said, "It's hard for me to believe that young and old can congregate at the court." "Well, they do," I said. "The lion and the lamb lie down together there. I shrugged. This is the spirit of the court. The old rule of hospitality prevails. All blood drinkers are welcome. All immortals are welcome. He nodded. Someone has to break that peace to be cast out, I said. And if Arjun cannot accept your coming, then he will have to leave. I've encountered so few blood drinkers over the years, said Fontaine, and always with discomfort and suspicion. My existence has been lonely, almost beyond endurance, but this Bodwin troubled me. There was something childish and foolish about him. He claimed descent from a legend. Perhaps he left because I didn't find him all that interesting myself, and he sensed it. Descent from a legend. But it was time, finally, to return to New Orleans. Cyril and Thorne suddenly appeared at a polite remove, and I knew, of course, by the lightning sky, and the song of the morning birds. I kissed Fontaine on both sides of his face and promised him I'd resolve the issue with Arjun as soon as I could. It wasn't until I was alone with Cyril that he confided to me, in a whisper, that Arjun was no more, and that was all he knew about it. When we reached the flat in New Orleans, there was a voice message for me, on my landline phone. It was from Eleni in New York. Lestat, you're needed now at court. Armand's already gone ahead. Seems Arjun has been destroyed by Marius.
Chapter 4 The following evening I crossed the Atlantic in record time, entering the chateau by means of the old tower, the only one of the four towers that had been still standing for my time before the restoration of the entire castle. The house was eerily quiet. The orchestra was not gathered, the ballroom empty, and I was told immediately by Louis that Marius had not spoken a word since the catastrophe happened, and that he and all the council were waiting for me. But before I continue with the story of Arjun's death, or any story for that matter, I want to bring you up to date on the state of the court and the village and what had been happening there. As many of you know, I began years ago to restore the chateau in which I had been born, and the deserted village that lay on the mountainside just below it. These ruins were in a very remote part of the mountains of France, and I had paid immense sums to the architects and workmen whom I lured to this neglected spot and challenged them to recreate the chateau, not as it had been in my childhood, with one of its four towers left standing and only a few habitable rooms in its central portion, but to rebuild the chateau as it had originally been, after the Crusades, when my ancestors were at the peak of their wealth and power. And on top of this, I wanted modernization, with electricity throughout, and the entire structure plastered inside by master craftsmen and floored with the finest hardwood parquet, creating what might have been an 18th-century gentleman's restoration of the place. For years I did not visit myself, but made decisions from heaps of photographs sent to me wherever I was in the world, and I opened the coffers for the complete furnishing of the place in the most expensive and beautiful reproductions of 18th-century chairs, tables, beds, etc. To all this, I added an immense collection of Persian and Aubusson rugs and tapestries. Windows were fitted with double sashes and heavy glass to insulate them against the cold, and even the old crypts beneath the place were refurbished and divided into proper rooms, paneled in marble. When I first set eyes upon the place, after so many years, it was as if I were dreaming. All four towers had been fully rebuilt, and the village itself, little more than a steep, winding high street, was walled in 18th-century-style shops and townhouses, and even a few manor houses had been redone in the countryside. Surely, I'd given permission for all this, but I had paid little attention to the master plan or the requests over the years, and I fell in love with what I saw before me. A small population of craftsmen and artists lodged in the village and regarded my coming as an event, and I struggled not to disappoint them, clothed as I was in a long fur-lined cloak with pale lavender glasses over my eyes and my hands sheathed in gloves. Complaining of the bright light everywhere we went, I soon seduced them with the notion that the village would best be understood and appreciated by candlelight, and they must forgive me for wanting to see it that way.
Through some 15 little structures we went, by candlelight. As I admired the meticulous recreations of the tailor's shop, the butcher, the baker, the cheesemaker, the drapers, and all the other buildings which had once made up the small community. But the great prizes were really the inn, of which I had the most painful and joyful memories, and the church, which was so magnificently restored that a mass might have been said at the altar without anyone realizing that the place was not consecrated. The craftsmen lived comfortably in the flats above these various museum-like shops, and worked together in large studios in the manor house just beyond the boundaries of the village. And a great map was shown to me of all the land I owned and how much work there was to do to create the old fairground where the yearly markets had been held, and perhaps erect another inn, a much larger inn, for the inevitable public who would flock to this spot to view the entire recreation. Of course, I had to disappoint them. I had to tell them that the chateau would be inhabited by a secret order of men and women who met to discuss philosophy and music and escape the modern world, and that there never would be a time when the public would be invited here. I could feel their disappointment when I explained all this. Indeed, it was almost anguish. Some of these people had devoted their entire careers to this one project, and there was nothing now to be done but to give them more work to do, to let the village develop to serve their community as well as ours, and to pay them handsomely for it so that they would go on working in obscurity in this strange realm beyond time and the modern world. Gold was the secret. Salaries became bribes. A physician was sent for and maintained to serve the local needs. Food and drink were supplied at no cost, and the inn at night was a place where all could eat and drink without, very often, receiving an actual guest. But of course some guests, some very unusual guests, the children of Atlantis, did come later. There was a great deal more work to be done, stables to be built, horses to be bought, an immense network of greenhouses to be erected for the growth of flowers for the chateau and fruit and vegetables for the village. And there were egregious lies to be told, but without any sort of boast, that is, told grudgingly, that we as a secret order imported all our own food, and those visiting the chateau would bring their special dietary needs with them. To my surprise, the head architect of the group, Elaine Abelard, with whom I soon fell in love, and with whom I am still in love, was familiar with my books, and had a collection of my old rock videos, and completely respected my persona as a vampire, and thought the whole thing charming, marveling at the wealth American and British rock stars make that could support such a magnificent enterprise. In his quiet and generous soul, I could see that he was convinced I'd someday open all this to the public. My hope was that I could bring him over into the blood, but not right away. There was still too much work to be done. When I first walked through the restored chateau, I experienced emotions I couldn't contain. I dismissed the mortal guides and went from room to room on my own, remembering far too much of what all this had been like in the time of my mortal life. Gorgeous salons with silken paneled walls and plaster curlicues and savinry carpets on the floor now replaced the miserable bedchambers we'd occupied in those days. A lovely banquet room lent itself to being the council chamber of the court, and the architects were still working upon the many apartments throughout the structure, and their modern marble bathrooms replete with sunken tubs and spacious showers. Vampires adore modern baths. They love standing in a flood of heated water, thoroughly cleansing the dust from themselves, and then shaking the water out of their hair, and drying their preternatural skin with luxuriant towels before warm little fires. Well, the chateau had such a bath for every apartment or suite or bedchamber. We give off no scent, absorb no precious oils, and often take up the clothes of our victims precisely because they do carry a human scent, and this disguises us as we drift through the crowded taverns, bars, and dancing clubs. But there is no one on the alert for us anyway. The great hall where my family and I had once dined, quarreled, listened to the demands of the villagers and the farmers, and hovered around the single fire we could afford, was now a great palatial ballroom with ample space for an orchestra of vampires, which soon came to be, and some 5,000 or more dancers. At later times, when the entire household assembled in this room, there might be 2,000 present in the ballroom. No one ever counted, except our resident doctor, Fareed, who is, to this very moment, still trying in vain to calculate the actual size of the Blood Drinker tribe. His most recent guess is 4,000. But then 3,000 have at times come together at the chateau. The fact is, no one knows what Blood Drinkers sleep in the earth or lurk on the periphery, as this one, described to me most recently by Fontaine, this enemy, named Baudouin. Now let me explain how the court itself became established and organized. I've described some of this in the other two recent books, published since I became prince, but I want you all to be acquainted with how things worked. And how things worked evolved quickly, once I had thrown open the chateau to all, and the word went out from one telepathic mind to another, and to all a guarantee of safety was given, so long as they would come with goodwill and respect for us. My fellow hosts in this were the elders I'd only recently come to know and love. Gregory Duff Collingsworth, with his family of Chrysanth, Zenobia, and Avicus. Dr. Fareed and his maker Seth, the son of Akasha. The ravishing beauty, known as the Great Sevrain, who had for some time been a friend of my beloved mother Gabrielle. And the children of the millennia cherished by me for so long, Pandora and Marius. Jesse Reeves and my beloved David Talbot also came to reside at the chateau. And eventually, so did the young fledglings of Marius, the pianist Sibel, and the creator of the vampire broadcast that did more than anything to awaken us and unite us as a tribe, Benji Mahmoud. Antoine, my old fledgling from New Orleans, had been reunited with us and became the conductor of our orchestra. And from an alpine refuge that had been a closely guarded secret for over 1,000 years came many more musicians, brought into the blood by Notker the Wise. For music was of such importance to him that it had become his way of moving through eternity. There were many others. Bianca, a long-lost love of Marius. Davis of the old Fang Gang. Everard de Landen of Italy. Eleni, who had long ago been my friend at the Teatro des Vampires. And Alessandra, a powerful immortal, who survived the fires that had ended so many of the old children of Satan, who had dwelt beneath the great cemetery, Les Innocents. There were chambers aplenty for all of these, and they came and went as they chose, and, over time, began to remain for longer and longer periods. But through the doors every night, for a very long time, there drifted new blood drinkers, many penniless and living from victim to victim, and a great many too young to live in the remote mountains where the chateau was located. I would not permit ever any blood drinker to prey upon the mortals of the surrounding villages or towns, and so that meant that many of the young, who were unable to take to the air and travel with confidence just under the clouds, could not stay with us unless protected by an older vampire who could shepherd them regularly to the thick hunting grounds of Marseille or London or Paris. But such a court needs structure, eventually maintenance, and even enforcers who can rid the court quickly of those who come with no respect whatsoever for what we were seeking to achieve. And a staff evolved, without my much tending to it, due to a young fledgling from America named Barbara. Barbara, like every blood drinker who crossed the threshold, had a story to tell that would fill 2 volumes, but it is enough to say that she had 130 years in the blood and had lost, by violence, the 2 elder vampires who had made her, forming with her a household that had endured into this century. It was not the burnings, as we call them, which had destroyed her beloved elders, but a random, violent raid by one of those marauding blood drinkers who slaughter others for territory. Barbara and her makers had lived in a venerable, old wooden Victorian home in a small university town in the Midwest, near enough to several cities for easy hunting. Theirs had been a quiet life, enduring for decades under the same roof, with Barbara, or one of the others, undertaking to teach at the university from time to time, and now and then traveling. In this little group, our books, The Vampire Chronicles, had been studied over the years with skepticism but respect, and it was to me that Barbara came when a maverick burnt down the old home of her makers, destroying them with it. Barbara had been in the city of St. Louis at the time to attend a symphony and came home before dawn to witness the conflagration. She remained near the ruins only long enough to ascertain, without doubt, that her makers were truly dead and gone, reduced to ashes amid the rubble, leaving behind only their unmistakable clothing. And then Barbara accepted the invitation to all, broadcast night after night by Benji Mahmoud, to come to the court in France as a guest or to ask for justice. It had taken Barbara great difficulty to cross the sea. She traveled as far north as she could on the American continent and then taken a plane to London, and from there another to Paris, from which she'd driven into the mountains, searching for several nights before she came upon the restored chateau filled with lights above a perfect village, slumbering as if it were under an enchantment. It was curfew, of course, that was responsible for what Barbara saw as she drove up the high street. No one among the mortal colony was then allowed out after a certain hour, except to go and come from the tavern in the inn, which Barbara passed, making straight for the broad bridge over the moat that surrounded the castle. I'd not been there when she first came, and did not meet her until a week later. I was immediately drawn to her. She had been in her 50s when the blood restored her to a more youthful appearance, turning most of her gray hair black again, and banishing forever a crippling disease in the joints that had been making the slightest movements ever more painful for her. She dressed in simple, heavy tweed jackets and long skirts, with brown boots to the hem, and pinned her hair back with a diamond barrette, her only adornment. She had a long, narrow face that was almost gaunt, with eyes that were immense, and thick, black eyebrows drawn quite straight above her eyes, and a full, ruddy mouth. Her skin was very dark for a blood drinker, and she told of a Greek and Italian heritage and an infusion of African blood through one of her grandmothers. I liked her at once, but more than that, I was impressed by her. She found the court astonishing, and she had gone to work doing all manner of things that needed to be done, from polishing mirrors to beating rugs, to unpacking crates of new bronze statuettes — I was always ordering such things — and antique Chinese vases, to fixing taps that were broken and righting paintings that hung crooked, and cleaning out chimneys that smoked, and picking up garments scattered about and trying to find the apartments of their owners. And though the cleaning of the chateau at that time was the duty of several mortals who resided in the village, Barbara assured me that there was no need for such exposure. "I am in love with this court," she said, "and I can provide what's needed for all of you if you will allow me to do it." She'd seen what was obvious, that certain vampires who had wandered in and clung uncertainly to the shadows would do anything to become a vital part of the household. Many had skills from their long-ago mortal lives that could be revived now to good use. Only a word from me, and their loyalty and submission would be unstinting. Within a matter of months, Barbara began organizing a staff of quick, eager blood drinkers who attended to every conceivable need while being the eyes and ears of the council everywhere. Barbara established a log of which apartments belonged to whom and which were empty, and how many solitary rooms there were, and saw to the endless supply of beeswax candles and fresh flowers and wood for the fireplaces. She kept my wardrobe, though I never dreamed of asking her to do such a thing, sewed buttons on my coats, and even mended a great velvet cloak that I refused to give up, though it had become too fragile for wearing. Farid was particularly delighted with Barbara's innovations, as he wanted to know the history of each blood drinker who came to court, insisted on taking a sample of the creature's blood, and studying it for what distinguishing characteristics he could find in it. Barbara brought the guests to Farid. She explained to them what was expected. She spoke in a soft, deep, compelling voice to all with uniform politeness, and her fluency in French and German was very helpful. Farid had made many vampire family trees on his computers and other complex charts, creating as best he could a picture of the common parents shared throughout history and throughout the world by the blood drinkers. His dream was to eventually trace the ancestors of every fledgling all the way back to the primal fount. but his lists and graphs were filled with strange names and blanks, and only occasionally some name common to more than two unrelated wanderers. We all agreed this was valuable information. Volumes were compiled for every single name ever mentioned, with a brief history of that blood drinker, even if he was no more than a character in the wild stories of a ragged vagabond. Farid wanted to take Barbara away to his offices in Paris, but I wouldn't have it. But Barbara found the perfect blood drinker assistants for Farid and his staff of doctor blood drinkers. At court, she continued to create new and refined positions of service, lists of duties, and saw to the matter of incomes for all these many workers, and that the young ones were under the guardianship of elder vampires who could take them to Paris and Marseille to hunt. She trained ladies' maids and gentlemen's valets, and had a collection of drivers to take members of the court over the miles to concerts or operas or films in the nearby cities. Indeed, Barbara created such a network of supporting staff that I began to wonder how we had lived without them. And the chateau was soon spotlessly clean, from its highest and smallest tower rooms to the spacious, open crypts of its cellars. It was Barbara who found dungeons I hadn't known existed under the foundations of the Southwest Tower. Excitedly, she took me down the coiling stone stairs to this strange stratum beneath the earth, where the walls oozed damp and actual prison cells remained, with rusted bars and heaps of debris that, for all I knew, might once have been human remains. Long, narrow air shafts brought the faint light of the moon to some of these places. "All this could be cleaned and restored, Prince," she said. "You never know when you will need this." "A dungeon, Barbara?" I asked. And there was Marius at my shoulder, telling me firmly that Barbara had a point. He gave the order for it to be done. New bars, new locks. "You see a different future than I see," I said to Marius.
"The problem is that you don't see the future at all," said Marius, and he made remarks very like those he'd made to me most recently about our nature and what I was denying about it. "If you ever think I'll keep a pack of hapless mortal victims down here, you've really misjudged me," I said.
The strangest expression came over his face. Then he turned to Barbara. "Come with me, darling," he said. "I'll give you the specifications for what we need here."
Very soon we became accustomed to blood drinkers who voluntarily assumed the position of servants, showing profound respect for all of us as surely as my father's old servants had, back in the 18th century, and for much the same reason. We had been beggars in those days, one of the poorest families of the peerage. But those old servants, whose ancestors had served us for generations, had counted themselves blessed to live under the roof of a marquis and have a bowl of porridge to eat every day, a place at a kitchen fire, and meat on holidays. I cannot recall a single one of them, young or old, ever setting out to make his or her fortune in the cities of France, where men and women and children starved to death during the harsh winters. "Just let us stay here. We'll do anything." Barbara recounted that plea over and over. She organized the tasks, the chain of command, banished curious mortals altogether from the chateau, and saw to it all knew the rules of the house and committed themselves to service. Barbara's last innovation had been livery. I had fully expected the elders and more modern members of the tribe to be outraged at the idea, but they weren't, and we soon found ourselves accustomed to a staff dressed in spotless black velvet suits and gowns and addressing the rest of us as Sir or Madame, Monsieur or Madame. Of course, I was always the prince, and now and then I heard someone referring to me simply as the sovereign. The sovereign. A small group of clerks was developed by Barbara. They kept the records, paid the taxes, opened such mail as came, and answered the only landline phones in the chateau, which were on their desks in their cellar office. And Barbara, presiding over all, wore a rich and lovely black gown with a string of natural pearls at her throat, and that diamond barret holding back her hair, ever stepping out of the shadows when I needed her. So this is the court to which I returned, in which some 600 blood drinkers were lodging, and a place in which I felt at home as I'd never felt anywhere in my entire existence, except perhaps
perhaps, in my old flat in the Rue Royale in the 19th century, when Louis sat in an armchair by the fire, reading the French newspapers, and Claudia, in her puff-sleeved dress of white gauze, played the sprightly, joyful music of Mozart on the pianoforte. Out, out, brief candle. Such comforting remembrance can turn in an instant to agony. Chapter 5.
So Arjun is dead? I said as I came down the stairs from the tower. Where's Barbara?
But it was Louis who met me. Louis was his usual rumpled self, his silk tie askew, a layer of palpable dust on his shoulders and on his once shining shoes. And he began explaining matters in a whisper, as if that had the slightest meaning in a building filled with creatures with telepathic powers. Not even Barbara could get him to attend to his appearance. I put my arm around him, and we moved through the various deserted salons, making our way to the council chamber.
What happened was not Marius's fault, Louis said.
There was a pained expression on his usually serene face, and a slight tremor to his lip.
Arjun attacked Marius, he said. His voice was a near whisper again, but I realized that it was what Louis did, lower his voice, the more emotional he became.
It had to do with Pandora, he went on. Arjun wanted to take Pandora away, and Pandora did not wish to go, and Marius warned him to leave her alone or face the consequences. They went out there somewhere, near the woods, to have it out. But everybody could hear Arjun, thundering at Marius, excoriating him for his interference, and his wild protestations of his love for Pandora.
I could easily hear this, though in fact I'd never heard Arjun raise his voice except in the story told to me by Fontaine.
And Pandora? What was she doing? I asked.
Weeping. Weeping in the arms of Bianca.
He sighed. Somehow or other, she had become the very personification of the conflicted, passive, suffering woman, utterly incapable of defending herself. They'd become like two wives to Marius, Bianca and Pandora, and Arjun was restless and wanted to leave. He claimed to have been reborn, ready to confront this new world, and he ordered Pandora to ready herself to go back to India with him.
She didn't want to go with Arjun.
No, obviously not, but she seemed unable to say so.
Did you see what finally happened? I asked.
We were drawing closer to the council chamber, and I'd spied a very few vampires about, mostly sitting together in small groups, in the shadows, as if someone had forbidden them to move, or speak, or dance, or sing, or read, or do anything. Barbara stood outside the room with her black leather-bound notebook in her arms, waiting for me.
No, said Louis, I didn't, but others did. I had my hands over my ears. I was trying to read, but all are in agreement. Arjun shoved Marius, dealt him a vile blow to the face, and sent the fire at him. Marius sent the fire right back, and utterly obliterated Arjun.
Countless thoughts crowded into my head. What was really going on here? Why was the house so ridiculously quiet, and what was on the minds of all the vampires who now sat silent in shadowy corners? What was on the mind of the council? I thought again of Fontaine, actually waiting for some sort of permission from this court before bringing a young mortal woman into the blood, and that maverick hissing at me, "By what authority do you do this to me?" And I figured there was nothing to be done but for me to enter the council chamber. I went in and took my usual place at the head of the table, nearest the door. Barbara took a seat to my right, away from the table and against the wall, and opened her notebook and prepared her old-fashioned fountain pen for writing. Louis took his usual place at my right hand at the table. Marius was in the chair to my left, but he had moved it away from the table, and he sat facing the assembly, but not looking at it, with his arms folded. He was wearing his usual long red velvet tunic, and he hadn't bothered to cut his hair, which he often did on rising, and it hung in a great mass around his face and to his shoulders. He was frowning. He did not acknowledge my presence. The crystal chandelier above was on its highest power, flooding the room with merciless light. And sconces along the walls were also lighted, with their tiny candle flame electric bulbs glowing. And no one in this illumination looked even remotely human. It was an assembly of immortals, some of whom might easily have revoked the label of monster. But they all looked perfectly fine and beautiful to me, because their preternatural skin and glittering eyes were completely familiar. And there were two creatures here who were not blood drinkers, not at all. Now, for those of you new to this narrative, I'll tell you who was assembled in the room in some detail. At the far end of the table sat Gregory Duff Collingsworth, the eldest vampire among us now, who looked, as he usually did, very like a Swiss or German businessman. He wore a simple gray suit and a red tie, and his arms were folded across his chest. He nodded to me with a quick and agreeable smile. His hair was always clipped short, and for all I knew then, it could never be anything else, as our hair never grows once we're made, and, if cut, grows back overnight. He appeared cheerful and happy to see me. On his right was Seth, who very likely was the next in age, having been made a vampire by Queen Akasha some 30 years or so after Gregory. And he wore a simple black cassock, like a Catholic priest, his black hair trimmed very short, and his black eyes fixed on me, as if he were not really seeing me. Beside him sat Dr. Farid, our beloved scientist and physician, an Anglo-Indian with beautiful green eyes, in his usual white doctor's coat. He was scribbling on a legal pad of yellow paper with his black fountain pen. The scratching of his pen was the only sound in the room. Beside him was Sivrain, born 1,000 years after the blood had come to Akasha, making Akasha the first vampire. And Sivrain, known by everyone as the Great Sivrain, looked the part with her glorious hair coiffed with pearls and diamonds. Her jeweled tunic of dark green silk looked very much like the kurta or sherwani worn by Indian males, and there were enough genuine diamonds and rubies on it to constitute a great fortune. "Good evening, Prince," she said, as soon as I was seated. "We're glad to see you've returned." "Thank you, Cherie," I said at the risk of being condemned for patronizing women with easy endearments, but I hadn't had time to restrain myself. On the other side of the table, right after Louis, came David Talbot, my fledgling, in his Anglo-Indian body, dressed as usual in a modern suit of brown wool with a caramel-colored shirt and golden tie, his wavy black hair short and combed. He, too, appeared to be making notes of some sort on paper, but his pen made no sound. To his right was Jesse Reeves, made by the great Maharet, a painfully thin, bird-like woman who in life had been pale and freckled, and was now as white as alabaster, her rippling, copper hair streaked with white, a woman who looks more ghostly than human due to her natural pallor, infused with the powerful blood of the twins, Maharet and Macari, who had been as old as Gregory. Then came Teskimen, the child of the millennia who had made Marius 2,000 years ago in a druid forest. He wore the same type of bejeweled tunic as Sivrain, only his was of black velvet and studded all over with beads of black jet rather than jewels, which gave it a wild glitter. And next to him sat two immortal creatures also made of flesh and blood who weren't human, the first being Amel the spirit that had, thousands of years ago, fused with Akasha to produce the first vampire, and who had connected all the vampires of the tribe to that host body. Amel, now in the slender, well-proportioned flesh-and-blood body of a young male, with thick, curly red hair and green eyes that were fixed attentively on me, his beautiful face breaking into a generous smile as I looked at him. And to his right, the female Replimoid, the child of Atlantis, the stunning, dark-skinned Capetria, who had constructed Amel's body for him, a being made on another world and sent to our Earth eons ago, equipped with great genius and cleverness and conscience, who had awakened in the 20th century from a tomb of ice to go in search of her ancient brethren. Capetria's quick, dark eyes were fixed on me, and she too smiled. Her thick, wavy, black hair was long and free to frame her face, and she wore, as she often did, a doctor's white, stiff, starched coat, like that worn by Fareed, and her arm was around the figure beside her. This was Pandora. Pandora, who centuries ago had made the unfortunate Arjun and become his slave rather than his mentor. Pandora, who often radiated a sadness so dark and bittersweet that it invited tears in others. She wore a black robe and a black veil, and her eyes were closed as if she were dreaming. Her head was bowed, and her two hands were clasped on the shining mahogany of the table. I could see very little of her curly brown hair, and not a sound emanated from her. Bianca, at her side, was also silent, with downcast eyes. And there was Armand, with his arms folded, studying Marius, his auburn hair carelessly veiling his face, his brown eyes narrow and focused. Minds locked. "All right," I said. "It's obvious that you've all been waiting for me." I wanted to ask all sorts of questions, and first and foremost, why Amel and Kapetria were here, but as I was glad to see them, and Marius began to speak at once, I listened to him. "Well, of course," said Marius in an abrupt and hostile voice. He turned to me and brought his chair up to the table. "I've broken our laws," he said. "I've struck down another blood drinker and burned him until there was nothing left of him." Silence. No one else spoke up. "So, of course," Marius went on, "I'm waiting for your judgment, and the judgment of all assembled here. I accept that Kapetria is one of us now, and is here due to this matter. And as for Amel, well, yes, Amel, our beloved Amel." He stopped. His eyes misted, and he swallowed, as if his voice had dried up in him. And then, fighting his emotion, he said, "Our beloved Amel has a right to be here too now." "Stuff and nonsense," said Gregory. "There is no need for this meeting or any judgment." He sounded completely human. If one were to go by centuries in the blood, Gregory ought to appear the most unearthly of all of us. But the very opposite was true. Because of his centuries of maneuvering in the mortal world, building a vast pharmaceutical empire, he had taken on a human varnish that was as thick and concealing as any emollient any of us used to pass for human, and his demeanor and his voice were completely human. His skin was tanned by his carefully planned exposure to the sun while he slept through the paralysis of daytime, and he had the polish of a great executive, used to giving orders to others and gracious to all. He went on talking. "Everyone here understands exactly what happened," Gregory said. "No one here has questioned what Marius did. Marius is the one questioning Marius." "That's ridiculous," said Marius. "I murdered another blood drinker. I broke the very rules that I've written as binding for all of us." He looked from me to Gregory. "Yea, gods," he said angrily. "Are we to make rules for young blood drinkers throughout the world and break those laws ourselves in moments of passion?" "Any of us would have done the same in the same circumstances," said Seth in a low voice. He looked at me and continued in a calm and even voice. "Prince, there were witnesses, though all of them were young, but they agreed on what they saw. Arjun attacked Marius, taunted him, and insulted him, and threatened his life. Arjun sent the fire at Marius with a stream of curses, and Marius retaliated, just as I would have retaliated." Another silence fell. Behind me the doors opened, and I saw Cyril and Thorn come into the room and take seats along the wall. This was never a good sign, but I wanted to remain attentive to the council. Sevrain spoke up. "Arjun was terrorizing Pandora," she said. "For this blood drinker, Arjun, women are not persons. Arjun asked for what happened to him." "Pandora, do you have anything to say?" asked Jesse. She looked to the others and then to me. "Should we not hear from Pandora?" "Pandora didn't stir. She didn't open her eyes. She might have been a statue." Bianca, beside her, quite close to her, attuned, it seemed, to the mixture of grief and confusion that must have been making this miserable for Pandora, did not move either. Armand remained silent, but I could see now he was angry. "Marius," I said, "what would you have us do?"
"Something should be done," Marius said. He bowed his head.
"Something should be said. Something should attach to my breaking rules to which I mean to hold others with mortal consequences. I broke the law."
"Ah, the Roman. Always the old Roman," said Pandora in a soft voice. "Always the man of reason." She opened her eyes and looked straight forward. "Arjun tormented me for centuries, and you have rid me of him, and I am thankful. I didn't want for him to die. No, I didn't want anything for him that was bad. But I longed, with all my soul, to be free of him."
"But you couldn't do anything about it yourself, could you?" Marius blazed.
I had never seen him so angry. He was glaring at her across the table.
"You couldn't stand up to him yourself."
"No, and so I had to do it. I had to stand against him and his brutal assumptions and cover my hands in blood when the survival of our tribe is now the only thing under heaven I care about."
He brought his right fist down on the table. I feared the wood would splinter, but it didn't. He clenched this fist, and I caught the scent of the blood coming from his palm.
"Listen to me," said Seth. "Surely no law we make will ever deprive a blood drinker of the right to defend himself against one who attacks him with the fire."
"I could easily have restrained him," said Marius. He was quivering with rage. His head was bowed. He rubbed his hands together now, as if he couldn't control the gesture. "I could have restrained him, and—"
"And what? We would have another Rashomandes on our hands?" asked Gregory.
"He might have come back at any time and sought revenge on Pandora, or on you, or on all of us. He broke the peace, Marius. You have rid us of one not made for these times, and not made for the enterprise here that is dear to us."
"I agree," I said without thinking. Then I realized they were all looking at me.
"I agree. And this, our enterprise, as you put it, Gregory, is everything. We want this court to endure. We want the tribe to endure. And Arjun was not a being who cared about this. Not if he sought to take Pandora from here by force."
"And that he did," said Pandora. Again her voice was soft, as though she were engaging in another conversation. "And I am grateful to be free. And, Marius, I beg your forgiveness that I couldn't free myself of Arjun. I beg your forgiveness that I lacked the strength. But I was his maker and his mother, as well as his lover, and simply could not do it." I knew this to be true. I had not paid a great deal of attention to Pandora or Arjun in the last year or more, but I had seen and heard enough to know that Arjun made Pandora miserable, and that her misery was increasing, and that she clung to the court in the last few months, choosing not any more to travel with Arjun, even as far as Paris. "I should have had your strength," Pandora continued, looking at Marius, "but I don't have it. And so you did this thing for me, more out of disgust."
"Oh, don't deceive yourself," he fired back at her.
She paused and then went on. "Perhaps more out of disgust for my weakness than any—"
Marius made a sharp derisive sound and looked away from her.
"For whatever reason," I said, "it's done. And I rule, based on all you've told me, that it was done with good reason and in self-defense, and that this be the end of it."
"I heartily agree," said Gregory. There were murmurs of assent all around, even from Amel.
"Is there anyone who objects to this?" I asked.
Marius rose to his feet. He looked at me, and then at the others. "I'm sorry for what I did," he said. "I'm sorry for my impatience, my rage, and my weakness. I'm sorry that I struck down Arjun. And I want you to know, I want all to know, that I believe we must abide by the laws we make for one another. We, the council, we the elders, enjoy no exception to these laws. no special prerogative to break them. I am sorry, and I give you my word, that I will never again, in wanton rage, take the life of another blood drinker. Again there were murmurs of assent from everyone. Amel seemed deeply moved by all this, and seemed on the edge of tears for a moment. But then this was very much his way, to have the easily kindled emotions of a young man, though he was far older than any of us. He looked up at Marius plaintively, as if he wished with all his strange, unnatural heart that he could do something to stop the torment Marius couldn't conceal. "Then it's done," said Pandora. She, too, was looking pleadingly at Marius, but he would not look at her. "And now," she said, "you can despise me for this as well as for so many other things."
"That is too trivial and foolish and self-indulgent to deserve a response," he said. "I thank you all for your forgiveness." "Then we can get to the more pressing matter," said Gregory.
"And what is that?" I asked. I wanted now more than anything in the world to tell them about Fontaine, to tell Pandora about him, and to have her assurance that I might bring him to court. But I could see all eyes on me now, even the eyes of Pandora.
"Rashomondes," said Gregory, looking directly at me. "Lestat, you must give the order to put an end to Rashomondes."
Chapter 6. I was quietly infuriated. Rashomondes? 5,000 years in the blood, living on his own private island of St. Rain, visited from time to time by his fledglings, Eleni, Alessandra, and cohabiting with his lover, Benedict, a blood drinker who clearly despised me for what I had done to him in the past, after his murder of the great Maharet, and while he was holding my son Victor captive. A blood drinker who had agreed to leave us in peace if we left him in peace. "Why in the world are we talking of this again?" I demanded. "What's happened?" For a moment nothing was said, and it was easy for me to understand why. We had argued this out over and over again. They, one and all, were for the destruction of Rashomondes, and I alone had held out against it, insisting over and over again that Rashomondes had been formally forgiven for what he had done to Maharet, and that he had done nothing to break the peace, committed no act of aggression against us. It maddened me that I could not get any of them to understand what it meant to me to pass judgment on a blood drinker who had walked the earth for thousands of years, who had seen empires rise and fall, and worlds I could only imagine. To strike down such a being for an error he had made due to the enticements of a spirit voice that had lied to him and manipulated him and goaded him to attack Maharet and destroy her. But never was there the slightest bit of understanding. Most of the council was positively adamant that Rashomondes should be destroyed, and those who seemed to care very little weren't in disagreement. "Amel," I said, "this is the first time, to my knowledge, that you've been at this table. Can't you speak up for Rashomondes?"
"Lestat, why would I do that?" he asked in his boyish voice, his face suddenly flushed as he looked at me.
We had seen each other many times in the last year, and I had grown used to him in his new immortal body, and at times it was as if the spirit, Amel, that bizarre and terrifying being, had never existed. "Because it was you coming to consciousness, Amel, who goaded him into killing Maharet. Have you forgotten that?"
This was a painful moment for the others, and I could see it. They were gazing at Amel uneasily, as if they had not forgotten, not for a moment, the ancient spirit that he had been, and were unable to trust the youthful, red-haired Amel who sat before them. They seemed not reassured by his obvious emotions, but suspicious of them. But Amel had always, from the very first moment he uttered a coherent word in spirit form, been a victim of his emotions. And he was now. I found myself deep in my thoughts, remembering that it had not been 2 years ago that, at a table like this one, at Trinity Gate in New York, these very immortals had spoken of imprisoning the spirit Amel in some chamber of fluid in which, blind and deaf and unable to speak, he might have lapsed back into a mindless existence of torment. I tried to drive this from my mind, because this was not a time to speak of this. But the Replimoids, whatever their immense powers, could not read our minds, and